Hello and welcome to episode 4 of The Call of Nature. We are a grassroots podcast about nature and wildlife in the UK for everyday people. So if this is your first listen, then welcome. I hope you enjoy it. And if you've come back after listening to previous episodes, then thank you. We're glad to have you back. So on this episode, we've got some cool stuff. We have a magic moment with Jerry, who's one of our listeners. He's talking about something that he saw in his garden. We've also got a chat with a friend of mine called Lucy Hellier about some of her early nature memories. Gareth takes us on a walk through some of his favourite local nature places as well. So there we go. We've got a bit of housekeeping just to start with, which Gareth is going to tell us about.
Right, and I've been told I've got to use my best clear voice, so here's posh me. The views and opinions expressed are those of whoever expressed them and do not reflect those of any other agencies or organisations.
Beautiful.
That was lovely. I could understand every word. Thank you. Welcome, Gareth. Welcome, Pete, my co-hosts. I like calling you my co-hosts. It's like you belong to me and I take you out on a Monday evening to do recording out of some magical bag. That's not true. But yeah, what have you guys been up to? What cool nature stuff have you seen since we last got together to make this podcast?
Well, I got very lucky recently. Took my little boy up to the woods. It was a super hot day, middle of the afternoon, and we were chatting away on a corner in a clearing. And a big black butterfly flew past with big white stripes on its wings. And I realized that's a white admiral. And that was really exciting because I don't think I've seen one before. Of course, I doubted myself, went home, looked online. Yeah, it was the week that they emerge around the end of June. I happened to remember it off my wall chart of butterflies that I've got to help me try and learn them. And so that was pretty exciting. It was so exciting, in fact, that I went back up there again the other morning on a cold grey morning with no butterflies, it turned out. But these are the things that I did find.
Well, I'm further into the woods now. I'm starting to hear some birds in the trees. There's a chiff-chaff further up. I'll try and get closer so I can hear it. And I can also hear a couple of long-tailed tits overhead going tit-tit-tit-tit. They're a funny little bird, like a ping pong ball with a lolly stick attached to it, hence the name. They can go up to 30 kilometres a day in their mixed flocks, constantly restlessly moving from tree to tree, picking off insects. You hear them arrive and you hear them go again. And they're really common now in the UK. They didn't used to be so much. I don't remember seeing them at all when I was a kid, and I was really into birds as a kid, but they're doing great. And then I don't know if you can hear the other bird calling there. Chiff, chiff, chaff, chiff, chiff, chaff, chiff, chaff. Saying his name, he's a chiff chaff. And in woodland, you can hear those all the time in the spring and the summer. And that's a bird that used to disappear largely from the UK, certainly the north, years ago. But with climate change, it's getting warmer. They don't bother to migrate away. They don't bother to head south to Europe and Africa like they used to. A lot of them, they just stay here. So I guess that's good news for chiff chaffs, not having to use up all the energy, but less good news for the species in the north that turn white in the winter, like the Arctic hare and the ptarmigan, who now stick out like a sore thumb. When there used to be snow, now there isn't. They turn bright white and the predators can see them miles away. But I'm not focusing on that right now. I'm focusing on being surrounded by beautiful ancient woodland, a bit of spare time, recharging my batteries in a lovely, peaceful, beautiful, ancient woodland. I'm surrounded by huge, beautiful trees. There's a massive beach in front of me. Its boughs stretching over me like the roof of a cathedral. The light shining through the leaves. Beautiful, dappled light on the silver birch next to me. I'm terrible at trees, but I know those two. And I can feel life's worries fading away as I just stroll through the woods.
Okay, Pete, I know I got in hot water last time for saying here's something a bit more interesting.
Yes, you did, and I've forgiven you now, Gareth.
Good. So here's something a bit more scientifically interesting. So I was looking at long-tailed tits, and it turns out if they had a relationship status on Facebook, it'd be it's complicated. It's like a daytime chat show of basically reproduction. So they all start off as monogamous breeders, but the ones that fail end up becoming these cooperative breeders. They help birds that are closely related to them to raise their young. And there's some sort of advantage in terms of genetic selection for that. The thing is, not only are they helping them, they're also looking for an opportunity to get in them themselves and maybe have a few young of their own. So they're quite sneaky. So not only they're sort of, you know, this masquerade of I'm helping you out, but also they're sneaky breeders. And they pick, strangely, the birds that are most closely related to them, which just complicates it even further. So there we are, long-tailed tits, the Geordie Shore of the breeding world.
And for any listeners in Newcastle, apologies for that prejudice coming from Gareth there. I've seen long-tailed tits, Pete, I remember a time down in West Sussex. We were at a nature reserve called Pulper Brooks, and there was a nest that was right in the sort of eye level in the hedge, and it was this little puffy ball of I think they used like lichen and spiders' webs off trees to make this little spongy ball. And I remember because the chicks had just left the nest, just fledged, and long-tailed tits look like these kind of lollipop birds, don't they, with like a ball of a body and then this big long tail feather sticking out. But the ends of their tail feathers were all kind of curled round where they'd been like all wedged up in the nest and they'd just emerged.
Good times. So, Gareth, what are you seeing lately?
Well, as you know, I'm not much of a birder, not by any stretch of the imagination, but I went for a walk the other day and I saw this strange-looking bird sat in a wood just sort of looking around, and I sort of thought, it looked a bit weird. I thought it was an owl or something. So I got my binoculars out and sort of tried to get a little bit closer, and I got up as close as I possibly could, and it was a goshawk, which are these sort of amazing woodland-hunting birds that can just fly so fast through woodlands. I just sort of stood there. I was like, I'd never seen one before, to be honest, in all my life, and just waiting for it to go off. And it took off at such a speed through this woodland. It was amazing.
Wow. I think I've only ever seen them like from a distance, but yeah, they're like they're like really brutal, powerful things, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. I read that when most raptors appear, you'll get a lot of alarm calling. But when a goshawk appears in the woods, everything just goes silent and just hopes to God that it doesn't spot them. They're called goshawks because it derives from the fact that they can take geese, doesn't it?
Oh, and that just shows their power, doesn't it?
Yeah. So they're goosehawks.
Incredible. Well, I can't really compete with a goshawk, but I guess the most sort of interesting thing that's happened to me nature-wise over the past couple of weeks was when I was at work. I work in a workshop nearby. I'm a cabinet maker in the daytime, and the front shutters of the workshop were open, and we're right next to a really fast flowing little river. It actually goes right under the building, and it's about the time of year that dragonflies and damselflies like newly emerge and go off and explore their surroundings. And we had a couple just fly straight into the workshop. We had this big enormous like blue and green dragonfly, and I think it was either like a southern hawker or a migrant hawker. It's quite hard to tell the difference, but there's one of them that's really inquisitive with human beings, and it came and it was like hovering in front of like my colleagues' faces and stuff, and I was getting very excited, and they were just like, what on earth is this? And I was like, actually, it's a southern or migrant hawker. And then it's me a bit funny, but you know, it was just nice to have that experience in you know, with some nature in my day-to-day life. I wasn't really expecting it. So that was my fun thing.
Yeah, amazing to see wildlife indoors. Didn't you have a herring gull in your bedroom once, Chris, didn't you tell me?
Oh, yeah, I did. I used to live in Brighton, right on the seafront, and the herring gulls used to nest on the buildings outside, which I loved. And I used to feed them baked beans sometimes when they were chicks and stuff. It was a hot evening, had my window open, and it wasn't a chick, it was an adult, accidentally kind of clattered into my bedroom, tiny little bedroom, did about two laps. We both were in absolute panic about the whole situation, and then managed to find its way out again. But I don't think either of us enjoyed it really.
No.
they get massive as well. I mean, I'd be quite interested if people could send in photos. I mean, because everywhere I go in the seaside, people are like, oh, we've got Britain's biggest gulls. But I wonder what they actually are. I'd like to see people, maybe get some photos sent in of what you think might be Britain's biggest gulls. I think it was Colwyn Bay was the largest I've seen.
Yeah, there you go. Well, if you win that one, folks, you could win half a stolen pasty.
So those were our magic moments from the week. But Pete had a chat with one of our listeners, Jerry, about his magic wildlife moment. So let's have a listen.
Jerry, thank you very much for joining me this evening. I just want to tell everyone that that you're actually a listener to the podcast, aren't you? And that's what led me to contact you. Although I should say we have actually met before, haven't we? And our mutual friend Max was the one who suggested that we speak. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right, Pete. I've listened to a few of the podcasts. Very entertaining. I enjoyed the silverfish the other day. But we've both know Max, and he suggested I come on and talk about the ex-estuary and things.
Well, I know it's a wonderful area that we've all spent time in, and I've actually spent time with you and Max down there. It really is beautiful and spectacular wildlife, isn't it?
Yeah, we're very lucky to have it so close on our doorstep. Living in Starcross, it's 3 minutes away.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very, very lucky. And it makes such a difference to the landscape to have that area of river between the hills. And it's always different with the tides moving in and out, so you're never quite sure what you're going to get when you go along.
Well, indeed, and I can't wait to hear about the magic moment experience which you're going to tell us about. But first, before you tell us about that, Jerry, how did you come to be into nature, would you say?
Well, I grew up in Croydon in South London, so I'm a bit of a geezer really, and it was opposite the Croydon Aerodrome where they used to fly Spitfires during the war and things. Of course, it was all disused, and so that was a big area that was just gone wild. And I used to get home from school and just jump on my bicycle, as I do now, except get home from work and jump on the bicycle and go and see the kestrels and things over there. There wasn't a big variety of things, but it was a lovely place to get out to. And from there, I just continued going out. It's always been Sundays. I've usually gone out on Sundays as well, Sunday mornings, no matter where I've lived. My dad used to do a lot of breeding butterflies and collect moths and things. In fact, I remember one very exciting occasion. He came home, he said he'd picked up an old lady on Coshalton High Street. Yeah, I know, he was very excited, but that is the sort of moth I hasten to add.
Oh, that makes more sense now.
Yeah. It wasn't that sort of a household. But he used to breed butterflies in the garden, and we used to go and see the silverwash fritillaries and things. And I still remember seeing my first buzzard with my father, actually. It was on a holiday in Wales. I was only about 7 or 8 years old, and we were driving, you know, an old Morris Minor down a road, and my dad spotted this buzzard flying through the sky, so he pulled into this lay-by, and we all got out and saw this buzzard. And that seemed to spark something in me, actually. In fact, it sparked something in one of the local neighbours, because she came out and shouted at him not to park there. So, that memory sort of stayed with me.
That's lovely, and it reminds me of the first time I saw a buzzard was with my family in the Lake District. So we're both from the south, evidently, aren't we? And you didn't have a cat and mouse chance of seeing one down here back then, did you?
No. In fact, my father lent me some books, and the buzzard section is quite interesting, because it says buzzards are now largely restricted to the Outer Hebrides. However, there may be one or two pairs in Devon and Cornwall. And that was 80 years ago. And now we've reached, you know, population saturation in Devon, haven't we? And they're all spreading east. In fact, where I grew up in Croydon, I think there's buzzards there now.
Yeah, I bet you're right. I was living up near Reading not so long ago, and there were loads of them around there, and kites as well, which is something we didn't used to see, isn't it?
That's right. They're coming back to the West Country now. So it's nice to see these buzzards and kites and ospreys coming back again.
Yeah.
After such a long absence from the British countryside. There's still a lot to do with raptors, obviously, and things, and there's certain species that do need looking after. But there are positive signs, definitely.
Cool. So Jerry, I believe you have what we're calling a magic moment to tell us about. What happened?
Well, it was a few years ago now, 8 years ago now, on June the 12th, 2012, which was in fact Father's Day. And my son came out with me that morning, used to go out lots and lots of mornings to sit beside the river. And that morning we'd been sitting there for an hour or so watching the birds. There was a few terns and things flying around. And then the osprey appeared, which was in middle of June, which is nice in the middle of June because it's not always around all year, or they're not always here all year. And it flew straight towards us and dived in, caught a fish right in front of us, and both Rowan and I went, wow. And it was one of those moments that you'll never forget. I did have my camera with me at the time, but I didn't want to get involved in shutter speeds and ISO values. I just wanted to sit there for the moment. And, you know, it's embedded in my brain now, and I won't forget it. But in some ways, I do wish I had a photograph of it, so I'm kicking myself a bit. You think, oh, that'll happen again, won't it? But it's a long river, and you only get so much time to sit there, and the osprey only catches so many fish each time, each day. And so to be there at that moment with my son on Father's Day was just terrific. So, you know, one of those moments. It's a bit of a cliche having an osprey as your magic moment, really. But they are such charismatic birds and fantastic the way they fly and dive in and catch the fish.
Well, that is indeed a magic moment, Jerry. And on Father's Day, out with your boy, that must have been lovely. Thank you very much for sharing that with us today. And thanks especially for getting in contact and contributing to the Call of Nature. We really appreciate it.
Not at all. It's my pleasure, mate.
Well, Pete, I don't know if you're just trying to sell us the X estuary, but there's been two magic moments now, and they've both included ospreys on the estuary. So what a fantastic place to go and see that species.
Indeed.
I mean, I'd love to get down there and have a look. Ospreys are amazing. Just want to say a big thanks to Jerry for giving us his time. That was really fun. I had a chat the other week with a friend and ex-colleague of mine, Lucy Hellier. She lives in Bristol and works in environmental education. I started off by asking her about her early life experiences with nature, and this is what she had to say.
One of the first times when I really got kind of obsessed with an individual animal and probably like noticed it at a very close level was quite a bizarre story. It's near my sister. We always used to just play in the garden. I grew up in Gloucestershire, and we devised this game called Super Slug. It's a good example of how children often learn about nature through play, but also quite often through like violence.
Yeah.
So we got really obsessed with this slug, and we started trying to get it to fly. So we had it on a little seesaw that we made in the garden, and we managed to like attach a little leaf around it, like a cape. So we started trying to sort of fling this around the garden. I think that's the first time that I remember being really so obsessed with one individual species.
So he was like the super slug in your garden, and you made him do things.
Yeah, mate. And that rapidly progressed onto when I was walking to school. I used to have to pick up all the slugs and the snails off the ground so they didn't get squashed. And so I used to arrive at school with like slug and snail trails all over my hands.
So through your own slug abuse in your garden, you reformed and learned to care about slugs, and then tried to rescue them.
I like to think so, and I've been slightly obsessed with slugs and snails ever since, actually.
Oh, my house is full of slugs.
Really?
I wake up in the morning. I come downstairs in the night sometimes to do whatever, or you come downstairs after I've gone to bed, go back to the kitchen because I've forgotten my phone or something, and like you turn on the light, and it's like they've been having a party and they've all frozen. Do you know what I mean? Halfway, there's like six of them on the floor, all going, "Oh my god, he's here! He's turned the light on!" And then I have to. I mean, I don't put capes on them, but I do. I do relocate them to the garden.
You don't kill them then?
No, I don't. Some people do. That's fair enough, I suppose.
They can get through the smallest little gaps. They come into my house through under the skirting board, which must be what, like a couple of millimeters maximum. Did you know that they have shells still?
Oh, do they?
Yeah, they do.
Internal shells.
Yeah, so the slug evolved from the snail, they reckon, not the other way round. And they gradually just realised, well, they evolved through time to kind of realise that having a smaller shell gave them different advantages, like they get into smaller gaps and go underground and stuff like that. So gradually they kind of evolved to get smaller and smaller and smaller shell. And then eventually just sort of ended up just inside their body as a little tiny shelly remnant.
Wow, so slugs are just like super evolved snails?
Essentially, yeah. Yeah, that's what I like to think.
That's incredible. I did see once, I remember seeing, and I can't remember where, some video, and I will post a link to it if I find it in the episode notes of this episode. But it was of slugs mating, and they sort of hang upside down and extrude, like stick out all these weird parts of their body and like do this kind of hangy upside down writhing dance thing. Have you seen anything like that?
Yeah, I think it's from, I saw it on some David Attenborough documentary years ago, and it was shot like the most sort of beautiful romantic love scene with all this slimy mucus everywhere. Do you want to know the coolest animal I've ever seen in Bristol?
I do.
A seal.
As in the big things that live in the sea.
As in a seal. Last week, a seal made its way up through Bristol Harbour and travelled along the Bristol Avon. It must have been at least 20k from the sea. And I was on a bike ride, and I always look in the river obsessively because I once saw an otter, and I'm convinced that I'm going to see one again. And so I saw this thing in the river, and I was like, oh my God, it's an otter, I can't believe it. And I stopped everybody else on the path, all these random people, even though we were socially distancing, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I was watching it for about 10 minutes. And then it caught a carp, like a huge carp in its jaws. And I was thinking, this is really weird. And then I gradually realised that it was a seal.
That's amazing.
Oh, and have you ever done worm charming?
No, what's worm charming?
Worm charming is basically where you stand on a lawn and you just have to pummel your feet. Like, I don't know if you can hear it, I'm doing it now. Pummel your feet side to side like that. And the vibrations, apparently, they're not quite sure, but they think it makes the worm think it's raining, and so they come closer to the surface. So you get worms just coming to crawl out onto your lawn.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And you know what? I think I've seen seagulls doing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure I've seen. You'll have to Google it, Lucy.
I will.
But I'm pretty sure I've seen videos, and I've seen it in real life when I used to live by the coast, of seagulls dancing on like flat grass lawns to drum up, to simulate rain to bring up earthworms. They're so clever, those things.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
Thank you, Lucy. Really enjoyed that. It reminds me of a flat I lived in Chichester, where we had slugs coming through every day. 3 years we were there trying to keep them out. There'd be trails all over the carpet in the morning, but we never did manage to stop them coming in. I guess we should have started naming them and playing with them.
Yeah, or charging in rent.
Indeed. Now, Gareth, I believe you've been out of the house.
You make me sound a bit like a troll there. You made it out of the house. Yeah, I have. I went for a walk, and this is what I found. Today, I've been walking down somewhere called the Golden Valley, and it stretches from Stroud Town out towards Cirencester, and it's a lovely mixture of these really old, wildflower-rich grasslands with some lovely ancient woodlands. And it's just a complete wildlife experience walking down it. And I'm a bit sad because usually about two-thirds of the way down you get to the brewery, which is a lovely place to stop for a pint. Can't do that today, but I've been treated to some really magical experiences already. I've seen otter sprains, there's been loads of birds going around. I've seen some amazing wildflowers. There's lots of wetlands full of meadowsweet. I've just come to Three Groves Wood, which is a lovely small woodland block of beech woodland. There's this little stream going through it, which has got these weird geological formations called tufa, which are quite unique to sort of places like the Cotswolds and have lots of rare invertebrates with them. And it's interesting because you look around and you could be in absolutely any time. And it's always thought that Britain thousands of years ago was absolutely covered in trees, these sort of large, tall, mature woodlands. But a friend of mine pointed out recently that's because actually our understanding of what Britain's vegetation was thousands of years ago comes from taking big cores of soil, with the idea being that the deeper down you go, you're going back in time to look at what vegetation was, and you can look at the sorts of pollen and from that reconstruct what the vegetation looked like. So the point being that tree pollen survives quite well, and grass pollen survives less well, so you get a skewed image of that Britain was covered in woodland, so actually it was more likely to be a mosaic of woodland and these grass and plain habitats. And that's really what the Golden Valley represents. It's sort of me like that land of back in time moment. You step into this valley and suddenly there's an image of what Britain's wildlife might once have been. So I've come out of the woodland now and I've just hit this tiny little valley called Dimmel's Dale, and it's awash with wildflowers. There's purples, there's yellows, there's blues. There's a lovely plant here called betony, which is this sort of tall, trumpet-like flowers that's popping up everywhere. There's a yellow wash of St. John's Wort, and this other plant, which has got this lovely bobbin blue head, sort of a mauve head, called Devil's Spit Scabies, which is fantastic for butterflies like the rare marsh fritillary, which once used to be found at this site, and hopefully will come back one day. And it's really important on sites like this that you have a nice, gentle transition from the woodland into the grass, and having these sharp edges where there's no scrub in between means that you lose that habitat for things like moths and beetles that like these really dynamic mosaics. So Dimmel Dale is a lovely place, and would you believe that they've actually spotted the nature reserve manager for Dimmel Dale? Right, so I've managed to track down nicest man in conservation, Alan Sumnell. So we're walking down the Golden Valley today, and we've seen some fantastic sights, Alan, and some of these you've been looking after for a while. So why is it important to work on this landscape scale?
The nature reserves we've got, Gareth, they're brilliant, they're fantastic, but they are isolated, and the wildlife that thrives here, it's like living on an island in the middle of the ocean. And what we're trying to do is connect up these habitats, so it's a bigger area, creates bigger populations, more habitat, and then everything's more resilient to future challenges that come its way.
I couldn't have said it better, and honestly, I haven't just been walking down here today checking up on you, so thanks, Alan.
Interesting stuff, Gareth. One question, did Alan say nature reserves have got a role, or did he say nature reserves have got to go?
I hope he said a role, because it's his job to look after them.
Alan is, I like the way that you said he was, what was it, the nicest man in conservation or something?
Yeah, I mean, that was coined as well. He was on Springwatch a few weeks ago, and Ellie Harrison called him the nicest man in conservation.
Yeah, but he is. I've met him a couple of times. We've been to watch the football together, haven't we? Yeah, he's a top guy. Although he does look a little bit like Robbie Savage and sounds a bit like Robbie Savage.
I'd raise you a lot like Robbie Savage.
But I'm sure he wouldn't mind me. Well, he probably wouldn't mind me saying that, but I've said it now. There we go. Hey, one thing I was going to ask, Gareth, is you mentioned early on about otter sprints. Maybe for our less nature geeky listeners, you could explain what sprint is.
It's poo, basically. So otters, their poo serves two main roles. One is to get rid of undigested food, and the other one is to communicate with other otters. So they deposit them on places where another otter is likely to encounter them, like a sort of a prominent rock or a log or a tree falling over the bank. And this one was actually linking, there's down much of that valley, there's a canal next to a river, and there's various crossing points where the otters go across between the two. And this was at one of those crossing points.
So it's a bit like dogs like peeing on a lamppost, but they use the other. They use number twos rather than number ones.
Well, they use number ones, number twos, and if you'd have it, a number three as well. They have anal secretion glands, so they can do just a sort of just a secretion, so to speak, which is a adaptation that humans and dogs, well, dogs have got, but humans haven't got yet.
Wow, who knew? I mean, that, communication could be quite so disgusting.
Well, there we are, everybody. You've been listening to episode 4 of The Call of Nature. Thanks for listening. Anyone who's listened to previous episodes of the show or been along to the Facebook page or the website will know that we're super keen to get you, the listener, on. So if you record anything, see anything, you've got a story, especially a nature place from where you live that you'd like to tell us about, and maybe even record yourself visiting, then we'd love to hear from you. So there's a Facebook page. We're about to go up on Twitter. And you can also visit us at thecallofnature.co.uk. So please do get in contact with us and come on the show.
Yeah, it's super easy. You don't need like high-tech equipment. You can just do it on your phone. Press record, get chatting, send it in. It'd be great.
And it doesn't need to be like some amazing like SSSI. It could be like somewhere you go with the dog every day that you really like.
like Chris and I, you definitely don't need to be an expert.
Yeah. So thanks again to Jerry and Lucy. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with episode 5. And we'll also have a little bonus episode coming out in the next week or so, which is an update from a guest that we had on a few episodes back called Bob Smith, who's a nature guide up in Perthshire. So keep your ears peeled for that one. And thanks very much for listening. Say bye, chaps.
Bye, chaps.
Bye, chaps.
Bye.